Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In 2012, a new charity bursts onto the scene. It's called Believe in Magic and it grants wishes to seriously ill children. It has the support of the biggest boy band in the world. One Direction. It's run by an inspirational 16-year-old girl called Megan Bari, who herself is battling a brain tumour.
I've been in and out of hospital and seen so many other very poorly children.
But when questions arise about her story, they reveal she could be facing another very different danger.
What is this girl going through?
It wasn't supposed to end like this.
Listen to Believe in Magic with me, Jamie Bartlett.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday the 8th of May, these are our main stories. Washington has criticised a decision by Arab foreign ministers to allow Syria to rejoin the Arab League after 12 years in the diplomatic cold. Nearly 400 bodies have been found following severe floods and landslides in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And Belarus is to introduce patriotism lessons for children from the moment they start kindergarten. Also in this podcast... A spectacular concert has been held at Windsor Castle near London to mark the coronation of King Charles. Syria is back in the influential Arab League, 12 years after being thrown out for its repression of pro-democracy protests at the time of the Arab Spring, which evolved into a civil war. That war is still going on. 500,000 are estimated to have lost their lives. Millions more have been displaced or forced to flee the country. The country's readmittance to the League was approved at a closed meeting of foreign ministers in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. And Mr. Assad has been told he's welcome to attend an Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia later this month. The Arab League Secretary General, Ahmed Abulgeit, said the move was the start of a process to resolve the crisis in Syria.
The return of Syria is the beginning of a movement, not the end. The direction of the resolution to the crisis in Syria will take time for procedures to be implemented, and it will be gradual. Also, it's not a decision to resume relationships between Arab states and Syria. This is a sovereign decision left for every country to take on its own. In this decision, we're talking about the formation of a committee to communicate with the Syrian government and regime.
Hesham Shawish from BBC Monitoring told me what prompted Syria's readmission now.
The latest follows months of these talks on restoring ties with the Damascus government. There have been repeated calls for Syria to return back to the Arab fold. And Egypt's foreign minister summed it up pretty well. He said that all phases of the Syrian crisis have proven that there's no military solution to it. We also saw this increasing engagement with the Syrian government following the devastating earthquakes back in February. So those were met with this huge wave of solidarity and humanitarian assistance. We also saw two high-profile visits by the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, to the UAE. So that accelerated things. And we saw after that the Saudi foreign minister visit to Damascus last month. That came after quite a bit of reluctance, but it was very symbolic. It marked a major thaw in relations between Saudi Arabia and Syria. And it came also just after the normalization of ties between Saudi Arabia and Syria's ally, Iran. So the timing here is very telling.
Now, the Arab League has a vested interest in perhaps welcoming Syria back because the war in the northeast and northwest of Syria is destabilizing for the whole region, isn't it? How significant is coming back into the Arab League for President Assad, though?
It's very significant, makes all the difference. He's been in the cold diplomatically for more than 11 years, and the war has sort of been winding down. Even though we saw, you know, the bilateral visits and the high-profile visits between Bashar al-Assad and the foreign ministers of various countries, there's also been an insistence on the need to reach a comprehensive political settlement to the Syrian crisis. We've seen a surge in anti-refugee, anti-NGO sentiment in some regional countries. So the countries of the region are really pushing on a solution to the Syrian crisis. And they're also pushing for increasing Damascus government control over all of Syrian territory and the need to resolve the issue of drug smuggling into neighbouring countries. That's been a major concern for a lot of countries, especially Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Turkey and Lebanon.
And yet, this is at odds with how Washington sees it. There are still sanctions against President Assad from Washington and the EU, files and cases against President Assad at the ICC, the International Criminal Court. So the world is very split over what to do with President Assad, isn't it?
It is very split. We saw with yesterday's decision at the Arab League, it wasn't actually a vote. It was a consensus decision that was not unanimous. There were objections, and some of the countries we know that are opposed to increasing normalisation with Damascus, not just the US, but regionally, we have Qatar, Morocco, Bahrain and Kuwait. Qatar has been more vocal than the others. And last month, Qatar's foreign minister said that the reason behind his country's boycott of the Syrian government and the exclusion of Damascus still stood. Nothing had changed. We've also seen opposition by Morocco. They're reported to be opposed to greater ties with Damascus due to support for the separatist Polisario Front by Syria's allies. So that's Iran and Lebanon's Hezbollah group. So we're seeing geopolitics still play a part here and opposition to Syria getting readmitted into the Arab League.
That was Hesham Shawish from BBC Monitoring. Let's head now to the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there have been devastating floods in which almost 400 people have died. And that is the sound of one of the numerous funeral processions that have taken place in the village of Bushushu on the edge of Lake Kivu, where landslides smothered dozens of houses with mud and rocks. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told me more about the impact across the affected area.
The pictures are extraordinary, and these two villages, Bushushu and Nyamukubi, some show mud sort of halfway up the buildings, a lot of wooden structures with corrugated iron roofs that have just been completely flattened either by the mud or the floodwaters, and some very, very powerful testimony from some of the survivors whose lives, it's difficult to imagine that the scale of the tragedy some of them have gone through or are going through now. Sifa Sakina, she says she lost her husband and is now left alone with five children. Then her husband of some of the flood victims, he said he lost his wife and 16 children. He said all of them are gone. He's alone at home now. We're hearing stories of people who literally, went to see friends, and then as the floodwaters rushed down, they returned to their homes to find them gone and their entire families washed away. So extraordinary scale of this tragedy. And as you mentioned there with the Red Cross workers, some of the bodies have been found in Lake Kivu, which is just downstream from these two villages. It's quite likely that a lot more bodies are going to be found. But the rescue efforts are very difficult because access to that area, roads are not really passable. The government sent a boat with food on board. But people have literally been digging through the mud with bare hands and using shovels.
And this comes just, a few days after similar floods and landslides in Rwanda, which is pretty much the other side of Lake Kivu. And the UN is nodding to climate change.
That's right. 130 people died in Rwanda and 5,000 homes destroyed last week. And the UN chief, Antonio Guterres, is saying that this is clear evidence of the impact of climate change, and saying that these people have not contributed at all to global warming. And that's the tragedy of this.
That was our Africa regional editor, Will Ross. What exactly is the head of Russia's Wagner mercenary group up to? Just a day ago, you may recall, Yevgeny Prigozhin said he was going to pull his forces out of Bakhmut. That's the city in eastern Ukraine that they've been fighting to capture for many months. There have been hints today, though, that he's changed his mind, saying Moscow has agreed to his demands for more ammunition. Elsewhere, Russia says it fended off drone attacks over occupied Crimea amid speculation of a Ukrainian counteroffensive. Hugo Beshega reports from Kyiv.
2 days ago, Yevgeny Prigozhin berated the Russian military leadership. He accused them of holding back crucial supplies to his men and said they would leave Bakhmut. Today, an apparent U-turn. In this message, he said he had been given a promise that weapons and ammunition would be supplied, indicating that his troops would continue fighting. This change of heart shouldn't come as a surprise. Prigozhin hasn't followed through on earlier threats, so everything he says should be taken with great skepticism. Here in Ukraine, a military spokesman dismissed the comments, saying they were aimed at distracting from the heavy losses Wagner had suffered. In Russian-occupied Crimea, the local authority said Ukraine had launched an attack with drones overnight. This is the latest in a series of reported strikes on Russian-controlled territory ahead of a much-anticipated Ukrainian offensive.
That was Hugo Bashega. Let's carry on with the effects of Russia's invasion of Ukraine now with another story, because the UN's nuclear agency is once again sounding the alarm over the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. That is the largest in Europe. The Russians seized the plant just days after their invasion in February of last year. And since then, exchanges of fire have frequently occurred near the facility, with both sides blaming the other. But what's now led the IAEA to warn of a potentially dangerous situation developing at Zaporizhzhia are fears of an outbreak of full-scale hostilities near there. Russia has begun evacuating areas around the plant ahead of the widely expected spring offensive by Ukraine, which is likely to take in the Zaporizhzhia region. Julian Marshall spoke to the Director General of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, about his concerns. This is what Mr. Grossi had to say.
We have been worrying about this nuclear power plant for more than a year, as you know. And the latest news from the plant and from the village nearby, Energodar is called, about the evacuation of civilians from there, of course, raises the alarm levels, since quite obviously, and this is common sense, when military authorities decide to evacuate people, is because they have either information or plans about possible military operations. Perhaps the audience should be reminded that the evacuation of people is only 5 kilometers away from the nuclear power plant, which is itself not being evacuated. But this means that the whole region encompassing the nuclear site is regarded as a place that is under a higher degree of alert. So this is why we are worrying.
You're concerned about the outbreak of full-scale hostilities in the region of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant.
Well, there is a possibility of that happening, of course, and this is why we believe that we need to come to some agreement. You know that I have been working with Ukraine and with Russia on a set of principles to be observed regarding the safety and the security of the plant. So I think that when all indications point to higher levels of military activity, and I was there a few weeks ago, and I could see that. I had to go through minefields to get to the plant. So I think it's time we get back to our senses and get some agreement, at least at the minimum level, of avoiding a nuclear catastrophe. That, I think, is not too much to ask.
I mean, is that really possible, a nuclear catastrophe, as you call it?
Well, if there is open combat around a nuclear 6 reactors, can I exclude that? I can't. Then I have to say, let's stop this. Let's protect the nuclear power plant.
And are those 6 reactors functioning at the moment?
They are not producing power. They are in what we call cold shutdown at a very low level. But the material is there, 6 big core loaded with nuclear material. So I think it is obvious that irrespective of the fact that the plant may or may not be producing energy for electricity, the nuclear danger is still there.
And what have they been telling you? I mean, what have the Russians been telling you why they're evacuating?
Well, they will not tell you why, because this is a military consideration. They will tell you that the security situation, in their estimation, warrants civilians to be evacuated.
Yevgeny Belitsky, the Russian-installed head of the region, said increased shelling by the Ukrainians was to blame for these evacuations. Have you been able to confirm that?
I don't have any element to say whether this Ukrainian or who is shelling. Shelling there is. My teams can confirm that. Even when I'm in contact with them over the phone, like we are now, I can hear that. So there is shelling around the plant. Yes, there is.
That was Rafael Grossi. Children in Belarus are to be given lessons on how to be patriotic from the time they start kindergarten. The country's Deputy Prime Minister, Ihar Petrushenko, told state television that what he called the patriotism gene needed to be developed. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, has more details.
It's certainly an interesting time for the announcement. Belarusian children will be taught patriotism lessons and will eventually receive what's been called military patriotic education in schools. That way, the Deputy Prime Minister said, they become real citizens and true patriots. Respect for symbols will apparently be taught, along with knowledge of the Belarusian national anthem, its coat of arms and flag. It was important, Ihar Petrushenko added, for children to know their history. But many Belarusians have been uneasy to see Russia use their country as a springboard for its invasion of Ukraine. Russian troops also now have bases there for training. The Belarusian government may be trying to assert its own patriotic credentials, lest anyone think they're being too compliant with the demands of their Russian neighbour. Meanwhile, the human rights group Vyazna announced that an anti-government critic had died in prison. 61-year-old Nikolai Klimovich was given a one-year sentence in February for drawing a caricature of the Belarusian president. Alexander Lukashenko has cracked down with increasing severity on any political opposition to his rule. The exiled opposition leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, said news of the death had left her heartbroken.
Paul Moss. Still to come, a spectacular concert has been held at Windsor Castle near London to mark the coronation of King Charles.
Richie got the whole royal family on their feet. What a night it must have been for him, seeing the king dancing to one of your songs. And it did really look like they were enjoying themselves, relaxing.
The Global Jigsaw is the new podcast from BBC Monitoring, the BBC team tracking and analysing media in 100 languages. We're lifting the language barrier, showing you the world through the eyes of its media, where conflicting narratives are competing to influence your views. Search for the Global Jigsaw wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Since 2015, more than 7 million people have emigrated from Venezuela, largely because of economic hardship. Most of them have ended up in neighbouring Colombia or in Peru. And Peru has recently tightened up its borders. And that has meant that some Venezuelans trying to get in have found themselves in limbo. One group, stranded at makeshift camps in Chile, are now going home, though. Our Latin America reporter, Mimi Swabi, told me more.
It really is a crisis. The conditions on this frontier between northern Chile and southern Peru, it's a desert, so the conditions are really harsh. And hundreds of migrants, mainly from Venezuela, Colombia and Haiti, have been stranded on this frontier now for weeks in makeshift tents. And last month, Peru declared a state of emergency in the area because of a surge in violence and crime. And that's really kind of encapsulating the atmosphere. People are very frustrated. They're trying to get home or travel further north, but they're not allowed to pass through this border. It's creating a bit of a bottleneck, a purgatory. It's a real state of limbo. People are frustrated. And Nicolas Maduro's government has stressed the importance of trying to get people out of this situation. And the flight today of 115 Venezuelans was because they are the most vulnerable. The families of their children are there, so they're getting out first.
So it's a case of, I mean, these Venezuelans, they left Venezuela probably because they couldn't make ends meet, ended up in Chile, but it was a lesser of two evils going back home because the conditions were so bad. And we're now seeing countries like Peru tightening up its borders. They've taken in loads of Venezuelans in the past. So are we seeing them now saying, look, enough is enough, that this is our policy from now on?
It seems like many are trying to kind of really press down or make their policies harder. Chile has sent soldiers to the border to try and help control the entry of undocumented migrants. And that's the real issue. Countries now focusing on undocumented migrants. Peru has made harsher immigration policies and blocked the passage so they cannot get through. And it's this increased effort because of increased pressure that the Venezuelan government has had to act with these reparation flights. And it's all part of this programme called Return to the Homeland, trying to get people, the thousands, they said, from Venezuela who have been displaced and have been wandering really around this continent now, trying to find a home or trying to survive in better conditions. They're resorting back to Venezuela and really hoping that this could be a last resort to try and make a living somewhere.
That was Mimi Swaby. South Korean culture has been sweeping the world for nearly three decades, growing increasingly popular. From K-pop and Oscar-winning films to K-fashion and K-beauty, it is everywhere, including at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, where there's an exhibition running on the South Korean cultural wave known as Hallyu. Eleanor Sly has been to visit and sent this report.
Gangnam Style, the first ever video to reach 1 billion views on YouTube and the hit that back in 2012 catapulted South Korean music and culture out of Asia to a global audience. Here in London, the Victoria and Albert Museum is running an exhibition on the global spread of South Korean culture, which has boomed in popularity in the last 30 years. In Korean, this phenomenon is known by the term Hallyu, which in English translates to Korean wave. Eugene Choi is one of the exhibition's main curators.
Some of our visitors who were looking at the Korean collection at the museum were coming from different points of view. So some of the older generation had a memory of Korea as a war-torn country in the rubbles from the Korean War, whereas some of our younger audience were engaging with our Korean objects through the lens of Hallyu. And so we wanted to connect those two separate views of Korea and tell the history of how South Korean pop culture has really come into prominence in the last 30 years.
Hi, I'm Freddie. I'm from London.
Freddie is a 27-year-old fan of South Korean culture.
I've always been into a lot of different fandoms, and I was really into Japanese culture for a long time. I was really into anime, and I hit a bit of a low point in 2021, and I said to my friends, oh, if things don't start getting better, I'm just going to become a K-pop stan just to feel something. And then I gave it a go, and it changed my life, genuinely changed my life.
One of the reasons K-pop reaches young people around the world is the South Korean government's active role in promoting cultural exports. They now play an important role in the economy.
Set on a few steps above ground to allow for the plumbing irrigation.
Back in the V&A, and we're in the K-drama section. There's a recreation of the famous mould-infested basement bathroom from the Oscar-winning film Parasite. Next to this is a display dedicated to another Oscar winner, Minari.
One of the stories in Hallyu that we wanted to bring up is also the role of Asian diaspora, Korean diaspora, in making Hallyu popular.
The film tells the story of a South Korean family who emigrated to America in the 1970s. On display is a collection of fictional family photographs taken from the film set. Next to these are images of the Korean community in London, Europe's largest, taken by the British-Korean photographer Chan Yang Kim. I met him in a park near his house.
I remember some kids in Manchester when I was taking photos. They're like, oh, BTS, BTS. And I didn't really know who they were at the time, but I think they're massive in Asia, so it's a band. I hadn't really explored the Korean side of my identity. But now I was like, okay, maybe I'll explore the other side. So I was kind of doing my research and then I realised, oh, there's this place down in London called New Mold, and it's been like the nexus for Koreans in the UK.
Almost three decades into South Korea's gamble on cultural exports, Hallyu is everywhere. It's not just K-pop and K-drama anymore. It's food, literature, house music, and it's taken over the halls of one of London's most famous museums.
That was Eleanor Sly reporting. The eye was rimmed with fire, but was itself glazed, yellow as a cat's, watchful and intent. That was J.R.R. Tolkien's description of his villain Sauron from Lord of the Rings. But now a new group of butterflies has been named after that evil character, and it's hoped it might help conservation efforts. So what's going on? The newsroom's David Lewis has the details.
Sauron, evil lord of Mordor, forger of the ring, and now beautiful butterfly. And it's all down to some eye-catching colouring. The black rings on the insect's orange wings reminded experts at the Natural History Museum in London of the all-seeing eye described in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And the building's butterfly curator, Dr. Blanca Huertas, is hoping the unusual name might help the animal in the longer term. Naming them after key fictional characters helps to pique people's interests, she said, and that is important for their conservation. So far, a pair of species have been added to the newly named Saurona genus. It's thought more will follow. It's not the first time J.R.R. Tolkien's odious character has lent his name to a creature. Perhaps appropriately, there's already a Sauron species of dung beetle, a frog too. There's even a Sauroniops, a carnivorous dinosaur. But the Tolkien connection doesn't end there. Other relatively recently named beasts include the Golem attenuatus, a bottom-dwelling shark. There's a species of weevil, Macrostyphlus Gandalf, and the hairy-footed moss forest blossom bat of New Guinea. Official name? Psychonisterus hobbit.
That report was by David Lewis. We're going to end today with the hundreds of street parties that have been held around the UK today as part of ongoing celebrations for the King's coronation. The US First Lady, Jill Biden, was a guest at a party in Downing Street, and the Prince and Princess of Wales surprised crowds at a lunch in Windsor when they arrived for an unexpected walkabout. A concert celebrating the coronation of King Charles III has just wrapped up at Windsor Castle as well. Performing in front of the King and Queen and wider royal family and a crowd of 20,000 people were stars including Lionel Richie, Andrea Bocelli, Paloma Faith and Take That. Everybody! Our reporter Charlotte Gallagher was watching the concert and told me more about this last of the big set-piece events organised for the coronation of King Charles.
I have been with people, obviously, that have wanted to celebrate the coronation. They're fans of the royal family. Obviously, there have been protests and there have been people very much against the monarchy. But from the position that I've been in, being with fans that had camped out on the Mall, people that stayed there for days, hours, just to see the royal family, even in absolutely torrential weather yesterday that we saw in London, threatened to kind of wash out the coronation, but still thousands and thousands of people came to watch. And there's been this genuine sense of excitement and also that people are pleased for the king. He's pleased for King Charles that everything's gone so well for him. And the fact that the eyes of the world have been on the UK and everything has passed off really without a hitch. And then tonight, obviously, we've had the very formal occasions, coronation ceremony and the meetings that the king's had with overseas leaders. Tonight was a chance to let his hair down, Nick. In fact, when Lionel Richie took to the stage and he did all night long, we were looking at the royal box and we could see the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh. They were up and dancing, the kids were up and dancing, and then it panned to the King and Queen and they were up and dancing as well. So Lionel Richie got the whole royal family on their feet. What a night it must have been for him, seeing the king dancing to one of your songs. And it did really look like they were enjoying themselves, relaxing after what's been an incredibly long week, not just the ceremony, but all the long rehearsals. If anyone watched or listened to the coronation, they would have known that it would have to have been planned for months because it was so intricate. There were so many details. And of course, it hadn't been done for 70 years. So a lot of people that worked on it when it was Elizabeth's coronation aren't here today to advise.
Charlotte Gallagher. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker. The producer was Lipika Pelham. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.
From global current affairs to art, science and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.